Tom Gimbel. He's the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network. Tom, I said a moment ago that according to your talent index this year, which had a question among many questions for 2,500 employed professionals, you asked if they are satisfied or very satisfied with their job. And last year, 48% of the respondents said they were. What percentage of the respondents this year say they are happy with their job?
38%.
So down 10% in 1 year. What's going on there, Tom?
I think we have an intersection right now, John, that you and I have talked about before. And that intersection is coming out of a global pandemic, unbelievable political discourse, where you can't agree to disagree. You either have to be right or wrong. Not wanting to come into the office, and historically low unemployment, but yet people afraid of losing their jobs. And so you put all those together, and you've created an anxiety-ridden community filled with social media as the number. Remember when everybody got their news from the Daily Show? Now they all get it from social media, and they don't look at where the source is. You combine all of those things, you're going to have people who can't be happy because they're not giving themselves the ability to be.
And they're not giving themselves the ability to be. Is that, to what degree would you say that is because they're working from home and not at the office where you might get into a positive loop, feedback loop?
Yeah, I think it's a variety of things. I think number one, it is because you're alone. And the isolation does create that, number one. Number two, I think the people that are going in are then envious of the people that aren't, and it creates this keeping up with the Joneses on a flexible work schedule type of mentality, and you have this envy and jealousy, and it's crazy town. And so you combine those things, and you have people that want for something that doesn't exist.
How do you feel if I won't be specific about what the job is like, but if I have a job and I'm working from home and I get my job done, but in the middle of the day, I want to make a quick run over to the Jewel to pick up something for dinner, and I do, and it's between 8 and 5 when I do this, but I still get all of my work done that day. What do you make of that scenario?
I think that's awesome, because guess what? There's going to be times that you have to do work after 5 and on the weekends, and you're going to have to do that. I think that's called work-life meshing. That's called being a responsible adult who understands what they have to do. And it's being a responsible adult manager, employer, that says we respect where you're at. Wow. And we allow you to take care of
it. Tom, I'm glad to hear you say that. You're Mr. Go get your butt in the office and work real hard, aren't you? I mean, I know you have...
No. I'm Mr. Accountability.
Ah.
I'm Mr. Do what you say you're going to do. I'm Mr. If you put on your resume and you presented yourself in an interview that you're going to do these things, that you should do it. I'm not Mr. I don't understand that you have a life that you need to do things. What I don't understand, John, is why if you don't have responsibilities that need you to be at home, why you can't come in and be part of the team.
So if you have time to go to the grocery store, because you do want people in the office, if you've got time to go to the grocery store, then maybe you can come to the office more often. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm saying that people don't want to come to the office because they put me over we. I mean, and listen, COVID messed up everything. I'm the first one to admit it. But at the end of the day, if someone's paying you to do something, and they're giving you clean workspace and nice workspace, and this isn't like a union problem, and you've got computers and technology, and they're paying you a fair wage. You do what, you know, it's the same thing. I say this all the time. If you hired a babysitter, you'd expect the babysitter to sit your baby wherever you tell them to. Well, work is your manager or your employer's baby. And if they ask you to come in, come in.
Yeah. The LaSalle Network 2024 Talent Index, focusing on, among other things, this data point. When asked about overall job satisfaction, it's actually 39% of respondents stated they were satisfied or very satisfied with their current job, down from 48% last year. We'll talk more about this on another conversation another day. Tom, thanks for your thoughts today.
I hope to have my voice back at full strength next week for you, John.
You sound great. Tom Gimbel, founder and CEO at LaSalle Network. Philip Weiss joins us regularly on the Wintrust Business Lunch, the president of SciFarth at Work. And today we're talking a little bit about mission statements. What's the thought here, Philip? Thanks for saying hi. How are you?
Great, John, and thank you for having me. Yeah, mission statements are top of mind. In recent weeks, in speaking to our clients and looking at some recent trade publications on corporate compliance, and what's fascinating is while companies regularly take a look at their mission statements or core values, see what needs to be updated, a lot of that is happening right now because with the upheaval of the last few years and changes in the marketplace, employment issues that you just discussed with Tom, companies are taking a fresh look at what their priorities stay and what they can do for the company. And what's really interesting about those discussions, John, is companies have been asking us, is there any language that really makes a difference? Are there any words, when included in a mission statement of an organization, that just by the very nature of what they're telling people can make a difference, sort of what we would call magic words in a mission statement? And at first blush, John, you'd think the short answer is no. You know, words mean nothing sitting there on a page. But in fact, if you look at the business school research and in talking to our clients, there's one area, one category of language that if companies include it and reinforce it, actually affects their employees and managers. And that is a simple statement about taking a moment before you act, considering what you do, assessing what you do, because there's been this sort of rush towards profits, results, changes, serving customers that can lead, obviously, to either negligence or mistakes. And the simple statement articulation, hey, let's just take a moment before we press send, before we make that statement as a reaction, not a response, we can save the company money and we can save reputation. So it's fascinating to us to know that there's actually something out there that just by the nature of the language can make a difference in a mission statement.
I'm surprised. It would seem to me like a mission statement would be, let's be number one, or I don't know what it would be. What you're describing seems to be more sort of an inner office memo as opposed to a mission statement. What would be an example of what you're talking about that sort of does both of these things?
Yeah, and your point, your instinct, John, is right on. In fact, that's what these business school researchers have been saying. The idea that you want to make people be first, deliver first, prioritize the customer, has always been front and center in a mission statement. In fact, it's the most common language you see are serving the customer and creating those results and getting the products out the door, et cetera, et cetera. It's the fact that you add to that important element of, let's say, customer service and quality, the notion that we want to consider our actions, consider the consequences, thoughtfully assess before we act. It's balancing that, including that concept in the mission statement, that gives the employee, according to our clients, the permission not to always be guided by the pressure of the moment. And fair to say, John, to your point, not enough just to plaster it up there on one poster. You do have to make sure you explain it, you reinforce it, you show it to people in different ways, you perhaps train on it. But once people get the fact that the top tier, the top leaders want them to take the moment, we see remarkable differences. In one case, for example, at a company that focused on producing lab equipment, they changed their mission statement to be all about, from being all about the results first to including this consider the consequences and think before you act. And they found that their managers were far more likely to respond with patience when a complaint came to their desk, when an employee had an issue, and that resulted in many potential liability moments being escalated properly and addressed. So there's big benefits by balancing the messages.
consider the consequences on a billboard or on a poster at work, I guess is a good mission statement. It sounds a little threatening to me, to be honest with you, but maybe if it's followed up with, you know, hands-on communication from the management team saying, we're not warning you, you can't screw up, but we're telling you to be as, you know, empathetic or reasonable as you can be, you know, consider those consequences, then I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, that's a hugely important distinction. And in talking to clients, John, they have said, this is where the words themselves are not the entire answer. They're not the formula for success. Because in this context, considering the consequences is considering them in your own mind, mm-hmm. assessing what will happen if you say B versus A, if you react quickly as opposed to kind of ruminating before rushing. So you're absolutely right. You don't want people thinking the consequences is going to be a hammer from above. The consequences may be a customer who's dissatisfied later because we did not explain something thoroughly to them in the moment. So You're absolutely right. It's a personal assessment, not an institutional consequence or penalty.
Another smart conversation and trend from Philip Weiss, the president of Seyfarth at Work. Seyfarth, Seyfarth at Work. Okay, Philip, thanks.
Thank you, John.
Business space in Chicago and other cities. Ben Azulay is the president and managing director of Chicago-based Bradford Allen. Ben, thanks for giving us some of your time today. How are you?
Yeah, good. Thanks, John. Thanks so much for having me.
What's the trend nationally? Are folks coming back into the offices?
You know, I think it depends on where you're at. In some cities, you're seeing it more than others. But in general, I think there's some, you know, positive stuff in the market, especially when you think about people coming back into the office and how often they're back in the office. We're certainly seeing that in Chicago in terms of, you know, if you look at back in 23 compared to where we are today, there are more people back in the office.
The vacancy rate is about 20% in Chicago?
Yeah, that's about right. Right around 20% right now.
And that's better than it was in 23, but I'm guessing not as good as it was in 19.
Yeah, I mean, it's better. There's still negative net absorption, or there have been over the last quarters and years, which is never a great thing when you think about the amount of space that's leased versus the amount of space that's coming available. And so, that's something that we've struggled with. But at the same time, there's some positive things in the market. But, you know, when you think about the vacancy rate at 20% or so, equilibrium is about 10%, which means it favors landlords and tenants about the same. And so we've got a ways to go.
I don't know what that means, equilibrium. Can you tell me what that was about?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, where it favors one side versus the other. So if you're on the tenant side, you know, if it was the vacancy rate's under 10%, you're not going to, the deals aren't going to be as concession heavy because, you know, the landlords don't need to do that. When you're at 20%, it's just a lot different. You know, you're vying for a lot of deals with, you know, a fewer number of tenants.
Sure. But if the occupancy rate is 90%, then neither side, the landlord nor the tenant, seem to have much of an advantage. You'd like the business. They could go elsewhere. They don't have that many other places to go, so they'll probably try and deal with you. And that's maybe the sweet spot. If it was 100-0, if I may, then obviously the landlord would have all of the leverage in that situation, right?
Yep, that's exactly right. So in times like today where you're at 20%, what we end up seeing is that the concessions that are provided by landlords to try to get you into their buildings are much higher than if it was at obviously 10% or 0%.
So I'm reading from some of your notes. It says for tenants then, that means think smaller but nicer digs will be available, a pool table if the tenant wants instead of a conference table. Things now we're talking about that the owners of these buildings or the leasers of this space would provide. Free parking is an option these days, and no rent increase until year 6 of a 10-year lease. That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, all deals are different. So those are just some things that, you know, you can look at and say, okay, well, how do you get creative and what do we need to do to secure a tenant in a given building? And those are definitely some of the things, and especially when you think about, you know, value in a building and how a building values itself. You know, looking at just the rates and how you're able to achieve rates by doing some things a little bit differently. So you mentioned that, you know, you don't have an increase for, you know, in year 6 to 10. Well, it depends where you are at the starting rate. And so those are ways to achieve the same things on behalf of tenants and sometimes for landlords without, you know, coming out the door a certain way.
How unique is free parking? That sure sounds like a pretty sweet perk.
It is unique, actually. You know, parking, the thing about parking when it comes to buildings is they're usually managed by a third party, and there's only so much that they can provide in terms of parking from a deal standpoint. But it does come into play. I think the bigger thing is, John, is asking the questions. You know, so many things that, you know, maybe in a time when the market is tighter that are not on the table. In markets like this, I mean, everything's on the table. So if there's something that you're thinking about or something that is in a building, you should be asking for it. So something like, you know, free use of the fitness center or the conference center and different things like that definitely resonate with users. That in a market that's tight, you're not going to get those same things.
Now, I understand that the time that people are actually spending in the offices is around 50 to 60% of what maybe would be full-time in-office employment. Folks are actually there about 50 to 60% of the time, which is a different number than the 20% vacancy rate. So I wonder which is more important. I guess if you're the landlord, do you care if people are actually showing up into that leased space?
Well, I mean, if you're a landlord, do you care if they're showing up? I think that you care if a tenant's paying the rent, first and foremost. So if they're leasing the space, that's a good thing. But they do also care that there are people in the buildings. You know, that kind of goes to overall health of the market, and obviously getting people back is a big push in how you do that. And so we've seen that through, you know, some flight to quality. You know, when a tenant goes and they take space, they might pay a little bit more for it to be in a nicer space that provides tenants a lot of these, you know, perks, if you will. And, you know, those perks, part of the reason that the tenants are willing to pay for them is because they're hoping that it encourages their people to come back in. They're providing them this great space and the great building and with all these amenities and all that kind of then combined with, you know, retaining them as employees, it goes a long way. And so I think that just to answer your question that you asked, yeah, it's important that you're getting them in the building. But at the end of the day, for landlords, as long as the tenant's paying the rent and they've leased space, that's going to be the overriding factor.
I guess you got to pay attention to that, though, because if only half of the people are showing up in that office space, then that tenant sure isn't going to want to renew this lease anytime soon. They're going to want less space, and that will eventually come out of your pocket. And yet you made it sound like new office space is coming online, which sounds a little surprising to me, given the vacancy rate. Talk about that.
Yeah, there are some new space coming online, and that's there's not as much as was coming online back around COVID time right now. What we are seeing actually is that there are some buildings that are investing and upgrading what they have. So I mean, like, you know, we read a couple weeks ago about JP Morgan and Chase Tower, and they're going to be reinvesting in that building. So we see some of that, and that really makes a big difference.
I was so glad to hear that. I think a lot of people are happy to hear about that because that's real dollars you did not have to spend, and you could have just downsized or moved, but they want to make that nicer. I don't want to read too much into that, but wasn't that good news?
Yeah, no, that's really good news, and especially taking it one step further, it's a building in the Central Loop, which, you know, the Central Loop's gotten a lot of, you know, negative press in terms of there's groups that are moving out. They want to be in Fulton Market and they want to be closer to the trains. And Obviously, you know, with Google and their plans for the Central Loop, it's good to see other buildings that are also reinvesting in that part of Chicago.
Yeah. This is interesting. Ben, you and I will have to talk more about this another day and keep us posted on how the market is doing. Ben Azulay is the president and managing director of Chicago-based Bradford Allen. You can connect with them at bradfordallen.com. Nice to talk to you, Ben. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, John.
On the Wintrust Business Lunch, more business news. Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Hoffman Estates-based Claire's will partner with Walgreens, and that means some Claire's products will soon be available at drugstore locations. Claire's jewelry, hair accessories, and cosmetics will be sold in more than 4,400 Walgreens stores nationwide. Those products will be featured in the seasonal sections of Walgreens stores. Financial details of the deal haven't been disclosed. Claire's has partnered with more than 40 retailers, including Macy's, CVS, Walmart, and Amazon. Archer Daniels Midland's new annual report revises its intersegment sales for the last 3 years to the tune of tens of millions of dollars. The downward revision covers 2021, 2022, and 2023 and follows an internal probe into the company's financial reporting. ADM has also disclosed a $137 million impairment charge related to its animal nutrition unit. Despite the adjustments, the company says overall earnings were not impacted. ADM CEO says the company didn't have adequate controls in place to measure intersegment sales between nutrition and other units. A plan is now in place to fix those controls. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Time for the business of food now. Here's Steve Alexander.
Thank you, and let's begin with a problem.
A three-year-old can't tell the difference between a cannabis gummy and a real gummy. And they'll eat the whole package.
And get real sick in some cases.
Cannabis really seems to be the worst. About 30 to 40% of kids end up being admitted. 1 to 2% end up having seizures.
Who he is and more about poisonous food after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There has never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. There's never been a better time to change your thinking about those cannabis gummies and chocolates.
Whether it is a pill or a capsule, a tablet, or an elixir, or a gummy, it's still a drug. And it should be treated with the same level of respect.
Because
kids can't tell the difference between this infused food versus a normal candy or a normal gummy.
That's Dr. Michael Wall. He's medical director of the Illinois Poison Center. And
it is Illinois Poison Prevention Month. And it is, I think, the third week of March is National Poison Prevention Week.
There are always new threats coming along. Fun for adults, not for kids.
Gummies seem to be the most popular, but certainly cookies and chocolates and mints kids get into and can get pretty sick and end up in the hospital. The other common ones are melatonin gummies, vitamin gummies. A few gummies aren't going to be an issue, but if you eat the whole bottle, they're going to have GI upsets, diarrhea as well.
And here's something new.
We are starting to see cases involving psilocybin chocolate, so chocolates that have been made with magic mushrooms.
And here's something to consider.
Because a lot of people will store their gummies and their chocolates in their pantry or in their refrigerator and other places that they store food, as opposed to treating it like a drug where it's up high, out of reach, in a medicine cabinet, maybe in a lockbox.
Got questions? Well, the Illinois Poison Prevention Hotline is always on.
1-800-222-1222. It is free and confidential. And we are staffed by pharmacists and nurses.
That number again?
1-800-222-1222.
On the food calendar, it's National Baked Scallops Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Speaking of fun things to do now, Jason Lesnevich is the director of cultural tourism for Choose Chicago. Hey, Jason, welcome back. And let's talk about how to do St. Patrick's Day this weekend.
Absolutely. Happy to. Thanks for having me. And yeah, it all starts on Saturday, as you mentioned, right downtown at 10 a.m. Iconic event, bucket list event, dyeing the river green, of course.
Yeah, I was talking to some friends about things you got to do in Chicago, and they said, oh, I don't know how you, what do you, who do you? I said, it's real simple. Find the river, go over by Columbus Avenue. There'll be a bunch of people standing there, so get there early. Am I doing it right so far?
You are, yeah. It's get there early. I would get there around 9. It's going to start around 10. it takes place between Columbus and State Street. But if you're anywhere near the river, you'll get a chance to see, you know, it really takes over the whole main branch of the river. And, you know, there's river cruises that will start shortly thereafter around 11:30. A variety of companies, the architecture cruise, the First Lady, shoreline cruises, city cruise, having a bottomless mimosa brunch cruise down the Green River. So there's a lot of great ways to experience it, either from above, seeing it live, or a little bit later on one of our river cruises.
Yeah, that's a good mention. I'm glad you mentioned that. That's a fun way to do it. And that's Saturday, 10 a.m., and then at noon, 12:15 to be exact, between Balboa and Monroe on Columbus is the St. Patrick's Day Parade, right?
It is, yeah, right through Grant Park there. It starts about 2 hours after the river dying, so you can take that in, walk over to Columbus, and take in the downtown parade on Saturday at 12:15. And I emphasize Saturday because on St. Patrick's Day, there are two other neighborhood parades, and of course, one being the Southside Irish Parade in the Beverly neighborhood. And then we have a Northwest Side Irish Parade that many people may not know about up in the Norwood Park neighborhood.
So Norwood Park is Sunday at noon, and the South Side also does Sunday at noon. And like you said, that's Beverly around that way. That's probably the biggest, most famous, or best attended parade, the South Side one, right?
It's a great tradition. You know, it really started off small with some neighborhood kids parading around and has grown into this great parade celebrating, you know, Beverly's a very Irish neighborhood. And the parade goes down Western Avenue if you're looking for it on Sunday.
Any other events or concerts or specials you want to highlight today?
Yeah, I'm going to throw out, there's a concert on St. Patrick's Day Sunday at the Irish American Heritage Center. And if you've never been there, it's a great place to visit, but they're having an all-sister band perform a concert. They're from Ireland. They're called the Screaming Orphans, and it's pop music mixed with traditional Irish music. Should be a great time at the Heritage Center there in the Mayfair neighborhood.
What about Old St. Pat's? What's going on there?
Yeah, they do their annual block party. You know, I looked up tickets. They're saying tickets are sold out right now. There may be some at the door, but, you know, for future years, definitely Old St. Patrick's has a great block party, family-friendly, heated beer tent, activities, live music. So that's a great event to put on your list.
And if you want to just do Chicago and you thought, well, St. Patrick's Day might be a fun romp, that'll be a party, the weather's really just going to be so nice. I mean, some years it can be snowing and we're looking Saturday, sunshine, breezy 60, Sunday, some clouds and 45. That's not too bad.
Oh, that's nothing. Yeah, I've been downtown in the snow, like you've mentioned, and I think, you know, so come out early on Saturday. We do expect some big crowds because of the weather and just because it's obviously St. Patrick's Day weekend in Chicago.
ChooseChicago.com is where you click. ChooseChicago.com. Jason Lesnevich is the director of cultural tourism around here. Jason, good to talk to you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.